Well, good evening, everyone. This is our ninth in our 10th series, 10th lecture series. And we're going to be doing two major centuries tonight, the 1700s and the 1800s, which will allow us to use our last evening next week to cover one century and take a look at the future, maybe. So we begin with the 1700s this evening. Let's start with the Papal States. Benedict XIV is perhaps the most important of the popes in this century. He's a very learned man, but he's also very aware of how to act in high society. He's charming, witty, sociable, so he's able to improve the reputation and opinion of the papacy among the leaders of European powers. In Austria, it's not going so well. Austria winds up, toward the end of the century, with a Holy Roman Emperor, his name is Joseph II, who attempts to control the church completely. He wants state control of the church. Now, last time when we were considering heresies, we looked at a couple of heresies that had to do with state control of the church. One of those was called Gallicanism. You may remember that. It comes from the word Gaul. So this is French attempts to control the church or to nationalize it and make it completely subject to the ruler of that country. Another one was called Erastianism, from a fellow named Erastus, who had the same theory. Another one was called Reshervism, from a fellow named Reshir, who had the same theory. And here we get another one. This one's called Josephinism, from Joseph II. These are all attempts to, they're all pretty much the same. They want to say that Catholicism ought to break into a bunch of small religions. There will be the religion of France, and there will be the religion of Austria, and so on. We're going to come across yet another one in the 1800s. That's going to be called Febronianism. So all of these five isms that we've just referred to are all pretty much the same thing. You get things like this. Josephinism grants Protestants and the Orthodox free exercise of religion, restricts appeals to Rome, authorizes the publishing of works that Rome has put on the index, introduces religious toleration, introduces civil marriage, introduces divorce, nationalizes church property. That's a good one, because suddenly the empire has the wealth that had belonged to over 600 religious houses, monasteries, and convents. Reorganizes dioceses, appoints 1,500 priests to new parishes, restricts the number of masses and processions. So those are the sorts of things that you get with these various attempts to dominate the church by the state. America in the 1700s, most important thing there, I suppose, is the American Revolution. And right after the American Revolution, which itself was 1775 to 83, the war, right after the Revolution, you get the U.S. Constitution, which is passed in 1787. There's only one statement in the Constitution about religion, and that says, quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." So as originally passed, the Constitution lacked the first 10 amendments, which we now call the Bill of Rights. Those were written in 1789, 2 years later, by James Madison, and they were ratified by 3/4 of the states 2 years later in 1791. The most important of those, as far as the church is concerned, is the First Amendment, which, among other things, contains what are called the religion clauses. So here are the religion clauses of the First Amendment. The first is called the Establishment Clause. The second is called the Free Exercise Clause. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the Establishment Clause. Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the Free Exercise Clause. From then on, the United States had separation of church and state, essentially. It took a while to figure out exactly what that meant, but essentially that's the case. Sorry?
Still trying to figure it out,
that's true. In Europe, however, there is no separation of church and state. And France is looking across the Atlantic Ocean at what has happened in America and says, how interesting. So let's take a look at the French Revolution, arguably the most important occurrence in France in the 1700s. What was the state of the church like at the time of the French Revolution, 1780s? Top of page 2. Well, as you can see, French kings appointed all abbots and bishops. That's a privilege that the popes had been granting them for several centuries. Almost all of the positions of wealth and honor and authority in the church, in other words, bishops, metropolitans, abbots of wealthy monasteries, were in the hands of aristocrats. In 1789, when the revolution starts, the church is the largest landowner in France. It owns 10 to 15% of all the land, and of course it's all tax-free. The church controls the educational system in the country. It controls the marriage system in the country. The state doesn't. And it controls what nowadays we would call the welfare system in the country, the orphanages, the hospitals, and so on. So, for France to have separation of church and state is going to be traumatic. It wasn't so much in America because we were just starting out. We started fresh, so to speak. But in France, there's going to be a ripping asunder of what had been traditional for well over a millennium, where the state and the church, the throne and the altar, are coexistent. There's certain economic causes that prompted the revolution. The Industrial Revolution had started up earlier in the century, and this causes mass migrations to the cities, which causes unemployment and causes inflation. So there's a lot of unrest in the country. By 1786, France is almost bankrupt. This is because it's had some wars. It's also because it has an unmanageable national debt. We should speak. And it's also because it aided the American Revolution, put a lot of money into that. After all, France hated Britain. Britain was at war with America. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they helped us. In 1788 and 89, there's an unusually strong El Nino effect in the Pacific Ocean, which causes global climate change, and so you have a famine in France, and this really stokes up the heat underneath the revolution. Cost of bread, for example, that year rose almost double. And if you're poor, that's extremely painful. Now, at the time of the French Revolution, you had in place a system that's referred to as the Ancien Régime. The Ancien Régime, or Ancient Régime, means that system of monarch and nobles, the stratification of society in a pyramidal form. There were three estates under the ancient regime. The first estate was the clergy, the second estate was the nobles, and the third estate was the commoners. Now, the first estate, the clergy, really has two divisions to it because all of the bishops and the abbots are wealthy aristocrats, whereas all the parish priests and all the monks and nuns are commoners. So that one's kind of split, but nevertheless, they together form the first estate. Now, there was no parliament or congress in France. There had been in the past a meeting occasionally of these three estates. It was called an estates general, where the three of them got together. And each of the three had one-third of the vote to make any kind of a decision. So when, in 1787, Louis XVI, King of France, calls together the first two estates and says, "Guys, I got bad news. We're bankrupt. I'm going to have to start taxing you." The nobles and the higher clergy say, "To heck with that. We want a meeting of the full estates general, all three parts, where we're going to vote this down." So they call an estates general, where you have the first estate, the clergy, the second estate, the nobles, the third estate, the commoners. But it backfires because the commoners very cleverly say, "Let's change the way we vote. Instead of each of us having, each estate having one-third of the vote, let's have it so that each person has one vote." And of course, they're much more numerous, and they pass this. So suddenly, the third estate is dominant. And they decide to separate themselves from the nobles and the wealthy clergy and call themselves the National Assembly. Well, the king is horrified and says, "You guys disband." And they say, "No, we won't." And suddenly, some of the lower clergy from the first estate, the parish priests, the monks, and the nuns, no nuns, but the parish priests and the monks, go over and join the third estate. So at this point, especially since there's starting to be signs of mob violence, Louis XVI has to concede and say, "Okay, you guys are now the parliament rather than an estates general." And he orders the other two, the clergy and the nobles, to go over and join them, and it's going to be a national assembly. So what happens now that we have this new form of Congress in France? July 1789, toward the bottom of page 2, the assembly decides to write a new constitution. I'm sure that must have scared the heck out of Louis XVI. July 14th, a mob in Paris storms the Bastille. The Bastille was a dungeon. And ever since then, the destruction of the Bastille has been a symbol of the destruction of the Ancien Régime, the old monarchical system. July 14th, right. That's their July 4th. That's right, yeah. That's right. So the National Assembly comes up with a document a couple of months later called the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. And in it they say, sovereignty does not reside in the king, it resides in the people. Anybody can hold any public office. Defendants are presumed innocent. And freedom of speech, press, and religion are guaranteed. They got these from our Constitution. They still have the financial crisis. So how do they solve that? Well, they look over at what Joseph II did in Austria. He solves his money problems by taking over church property, and that's what they do. They take over all of the convents and monasteries and churches, cathedrals. They all become state property, and this is how they pay for their debts. The assembly dissolves religious orders. It forbids new monastic vows. The only orders that it allows to continue are those that are teaching or nursing orders. It even, June 1790, dissolves the French nobility. They've gone totally radical, as you can see. A month later, they pass something called the Civil Constitution of the Clergy. And here we get Gallicanism type stuff or Josephinism type stuff. It's another of these attempts to have total state control of the church. It does make some useful reforms. For example, it abolishes benefices that are without cure of souls. A benefice is a diocese or monastery where the guy who, quote, is given it by the church collects the income from it without ever visiting it. So it abolishes that sort of thing. It grades clerical incomes by the amount of responsibilities they have. So you can't just be a wealthy aristocrat, claim that you're the abbot of such and such, and do nothing about improvements. Bishops have to reside in their dioceses. Priests absent for more than 2 weeks are fired. These are not bad things, but there is also Gallicanism, state control of the church, built into this. The parish or diocese elects its own priest or bishop. Well, that severs papal control over appointment of bishops. That's kind of going back to that investiture controversy. Remember that one back in the 1000s? Who's going to invest the new bishop, pick the new bishop and invest him? Popes are merely informed of election results. New bishops cannot ask the pope's confirmation. Diocesan councils advise bishops, and whatever they decide, the bishop has to do. So how did the clergy react to this? Well, basically, they went along with it because it included those reforms, and those reforms are very good. Getting rid of absenteeism and simony and those sorts of things. Middle of the page, 3. In November 1790, the assembly requires clerics to swear an oath accepting the civil constitution. By this time, the Gallican aspects of it, where state control has been imposed, is galling more and more of the clergy. So only 7 bishops are willing to take the oath. If you take the oath, you're called a juror, like I adjure, I agree, I assent. If you're unwilling to take the oath, you're called a non-juror. So about 7 bishops out of close to 200 are the only ones that are willing to take the oath. And about 50% of the parish priests take the oath. We now start to get persecution of Catholics who are unwilling to take an oath of acceptance. Because Catholics in France are now feeling persecuted by the very radical government, and because the very radical government is also anti-nobility, Catholicism and the nobility become bedmates, as they have been in the past. But now this is reinforced, and Catholicism becomes, in everybody's mind, associated with monarchy, an anti-revolution, anti-republicanism, anti-democracy. This is a very unfortunate thing. Let's go to the First Republic, bottom of page 3. The assembly renames itself, kind of, becomes a national convention, 1792. And within a year, they decide to execute the king. He's too strong of a symbol still to allow him to stay alive. So Louis XIV is guillotined in January 1793. 3 months later, the government sets up what it calls the Committee of Public Safety, because there's a lot of rioting and it's having trouble keeping law and order. Well, this Committee of Public Safety becomes kind of a terrorist group with secret police and so on, and this results in what is known as the Reign of Terror. You've heard of that, I'm sure. Exactly, Maximilien Robespierre. The Reign of Terror is from September 1793 to July 1794. So it's about 8 or 9 months, but it is pretty terrible. The Committee of Public Safety guillotines somewhere between 35,000 and 40,000 people. That's an awful lot of blood in the streets. among them, you've got 2,000 to 5,000 priests, plus a whole lot of nuns get guillotined. Even more than that are imprisoned. Around 30,000 priests flee the country, flee France, where they join up with nobles who have fled France, and they work for the overthrow of the Republican government. The government legalizes divorce, first time in history, in Christian centuries, transfers to the state the registrations of birth, marriage, and death, restricts clerical dress, encourages priests to marry, tells towns and villages if they don't like having a church, they don't have to have one, they can close it. Just to show you how radical things have gotten, this is kind of the nadir of the craziness, they come up with some alternate religions, the government does. One of these alternate religions is called the Goddess of Reason. This is third of the way down page 4. In November 1793, an actress is designated as the Goddess of Reason. She's carried to Notre Dame Cathedral, which is now renamed the Temple of Reason, on a palanque. She has oak leaves encircling her head. She holds a pike of Jupiter. In December 1793, another actress, this time called the Goddess of Liberty, is brought to Notre Dame and is seated on the high altar. She lights a candle to signify that liberty is the, quote, light of the world, unquote. Where does that phrase come from, light of the world? You are the light of the world. That's Matthew chapter 5. That's talking about Christians. Jesus says to his disciples, you are the light of the world. But no, now it's liberty. Goddesses of liberty and reason were soon set up throughout France. Well, the government at this point tells Napoleon, who's an up-and-coming captain, now general, in the French army, go next door and occupy the Papal States. Let's take them away from the Pope. That will really damage his power. So Napoleon occupies the Papal States. The Papal army is pathetic. It has no possibility of stopping this. So the Pope calls out to Austria, come help, they're attacking me. Doesn't work. The French invade Rome and they establish a Roman Republic. This is in May 1798. The French destroy Catholic colleges, convents, monasteries. They restrict the number of seminarians there can be. They prohibit joining religious orders. And they take the Pope, now 82 years old, Pius VI, into exile, where he dies in France. Napoleon now makes himself head of the government in France. He says, we're no longer a republic, we are a consulate, and I am the consul, C-O-N-S-U-L. This is in 1799. We'll rejoin him when we talk in a few minutes about the 1800s, so put him to the side here. And let's talk about other aspects of the 1700s before we continue to see what happens with the French Revolution. Here's that fifth form of state control of the church that we were referring to. It's called Febronianism. There was a fellow, he was auxiliary bishop of Trier. His name was Johannes Nikolaus von Hontheim. But he doesn't want to get himself in trouble, so he uses a pseudonym. He calls himself Febronius, and he writes this book called On the Condition of the Church and the Rightful Power of the Bishop of Rome. Here's what he says. Christ gave the power of the keys not to the Pope or to Peter, but to Christians as a whole. The church exercises its power through the bishops. Ecumenical councils are superior to popes. That's conciliarism. We saw that back in the 1400s. Ecumenical councils' decrees are binding in a given state only if the local church accepts them. Popes are not infallible. That follows because if ecumenical councils are superior to popes, they can correct popes. Popes have no jurisdictional power. They're simply a symbol of worldwide unity. The church can change the primacy from Rome to any other place it wants to. How about Houston? What do you think? Shall we bring it here? And rulers should reform the church in their own states. So the French government can reform the church in France, the German government can reform the church in Germany, and so on. Well, obviously, the new pope, Clement XIII, condemns this book. Nevertheless, it's translated into 5 languages, and it's adopted by the courts of Portugal, Spain, France, Austria, and elsewhere. In the 1700s, 1800s, the church is very much under attack by states. They really want to wrest all power from it. Now, that's one heresy we're looking at here, Febronianism. A second heresy is called rationalism, also associated with a concept called Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, with a capital E, is a rationalist movement, and it really has a couple of forms. The early Enlightenment came up with this idea that we call deism, D-E-I-S-M. Third of the way down page 5. Deism is basically natural religion. What it says is, all you have to believe is 5 things. These were come up with by a British guy named Lord Herbert of Sherbury. Number 1, God exists. Number 2, God deserves to be reverenced. Number 3, the proper way to reverence or worship God is to lead a virtuous life. In fact, the only purpose of religion is to promote virtuous living. Number 4, sinners must repent. And number 5, there's rewards and punishments after death. So deism is an attempt to extract, distill from Christianity some core minimum and get rid of everything else. Bottom of page 5, there's a quotation. This is actually a quotation from a professor I used to have. When I studied with the Dominicans, I had this guy named Benedict Ashley, a wonderful saintly man. But anyway, in one of his writings, he says, last comment on page 5, the Enlightenment was essentially a search for an alternative to Christianity. First, deism, and then an agnostic or atheist secular humanism, bolstered by a co-option of modern science.
Dr. Hahn, this Enlightenment was a lot of this instrumented by philosophers like Rosenthal in France.
Rousseau. Precisely so. And now that we're moving from early form of Enlightenment, which is deism, to the later form, which is more agnostic, we're going to come across Rousseau very next page.
Great.
Excellent, yeah. Very good. Father Ashley's comments continue on the top of page 6. This rival to Christianity that we call the Enlightenment was not all bad. It fostered many values we all recognize today as genuine progress, such as democracy, emphasis on human rights, higher standards of living and health, the knowledge explosion. All of these in the last 2.5 centuries have been powerful arguments for secular humanism. Nevertheless, the latter phase of the Enlightenment, which is dominated by people like Voltaire and Rousseau, are really becoming not just agnostic, but even atheist and certainly anti-Catholic. They see the church as a bunch of superstitions that are left over from antiquity, and let's just wipe the slate clean and start over with reason alone. Freemasonry. There's details about those various people we just mentioned on the middle of page 6, but let's move on to bottom of page 6. Freemasonry is part of this rationalist movement that we're talking about. It originated in 1717. An Anglican clergyman, who was actually a deist, named James Anderson, writes the first constitution for Freemasonry in London, and that sets up the Grand Lodge of the Freemasons. The movement was not originally opposed to Christianity, and in fact, several Catholics, including priests, became members. Clement VII's bull, however, a couple of decades later, condemns Freemasonry. It's a secret society, and it is in tendency rationalistic, denying the importance or validity of revelation. In 1776, a canon lawyer named Adam Weishaupt established the Order of the Illuminati at the University of Ingolstadt. He did so in order to help dispel the ignorance of the clergy and the aristocracy. But French Freemasonry is becoming increasingly anti-clerical and anti-religious, so that by the second half of the 1800s, it's regarded as one of the forces most hostile to Catholicism. And that's the reputation that we're familiar with. As far as religious orders in the 1700s, the most significant event is the suppression of the Jesuits. The Jesuits were founded 1535, I believe it was. Ignatius Loyola, the Pope approves it, and they have been staunch defenders of the papacy ever since. So why did they get suppressed? Why would a Pope suppress them? Well, here's what happened, middle of page 7. The Jesuits have enemies. The Gallicans and the Jansenists don't like the Jesuits. After all, the Jesuits are pro-Pope. Gallicans are pro-state. They want the state to control the religion. Jansenists got condemned by the Pope, so they side with the Gallicanists against the Jesuits. In addition, other religious orders don't like the Jesuits. Remember, the Jesuits wanted the Chinese to be able to venerate their ancestors. The Dominicans and the Franciscans went to the Pope and told on the Jesuits, and the Pope condemned them for that. Colonial powers, here's the main reason why they got suppressed. Colonial powers like France, or like France in Canada, like Spain in Central and South America, don't like the Jesuits because the Jesuits are trying to defend the Indians' rights. And the conquistadors don't want the Indians to have rights. They want to rape their country and take all the gold and silver back over, and so on. So, Louis XV, now King of France, suppresses the Jesuits in France. That's the only place he's got power. That's in 1764. 5 years later, the candidate to the papacy that the French favored and promoted winds up becoming Clement XIV. So as soon as he becomes Pope, or not shortly after, he suppresses the Jesuits worldwide. It is temporary, however, because 50 years or so later, in 1824, another Pope resuscitates them. They had continued to survive in Protestant countries like Prussia and Russia, or non-Catholic countries. Devotions in the 1700s. There's an upsurge in religious life. with the practice of the Eucharistic adoration, devotions to the child Jesus, the Sacred Heart, Marian devotions, the nuptial mysticism practiced in many convents, the Jesuit theater with plays for Christmas, Passion, and Easter, and the popular hymns that served as a catechetical accompaniment to the liturgical year. All right, let's move on to the 1800s. Second of our centuries for this evening. When we left off the story of the French Revolution, we saw that Napoleon had become powerful enough to declare himself the head of the government. He calls himself the consul, and he calls the government a consulate within the First Republic. Well, he makes an agreement with the Pope. They both sign a treaty. This is called the Concordat of 1801. Neither of them likes it, but it's kind of a compromise. Here's what it says. Catholicism is not the official state religion anymore. Rather, it is the religion of the great majority of the French, the Concordat says. The revolutionary cults are discarded, like this attempt to impose goddess of reason and so on. The Pope has rights over the institution of bishops. Whereas previously, from the 1500s up till now, the French king had instituted it. The state returns to the church the cathedrals and churches that it had confiscated, but the state gets to keep all of the abbeys and monasteries and convents. The state, from now on, will pay the clergy's salaries. And that's the basis of it. However, as soon as they got done signing it, both of them signed it, Napoleon took his copy and several days later promulgated it in France as the new law that the Pope has approved. And just before he does that, he sticks on a bunch of extra laws that the Pope had never even seen. These are called the Organic Articles, and here's what they say. See how much more Gallican these are. The state must approve papal documents and decrees before they can be issued in France. The state must approve Roman representatives. The state must approve synods, catechisms, and feasts. The state must approve any new seminaries. The state must approve seminary regulations. Seminaries in France must teach the 1682 Declaration of the Gallican Clergy, which was pro-state control of the church. Civil marriage contracts have precedence over religious ones. Well, naturally, the Pope protests. That was not what I signed. Not only that, it's not what I signed. I signed it as a basis for further discussion. I never said it was going to be a law. But Napoleon gets away with it, and it becomes law in France. Well, Napoleon by this time is so powerful that he changes the French government from a republic with a parliament of representatives to an empire. An empire has an emperor, and Napoleon becomes Emperor of France. Napoleon the First. Naturally, an emperor needs to be crowned, and you'll remember back in the year 800, Charlemagne was crowned by the Pope. This is a very important alliance between the Franks and the papacy. So Napoleon sends a messenger over to Rome and says, "Dear Pope, come put the crown on my head and we'll reenact this wonderful moment in history from 800 AD. The Pope comes, it's the day of the coronation. Napoleon shows up 2 hours late, deliberately, saunters in. At that point in the ceremony where the Pope starts to put the crown on his head, Napoleon reaches out and grabs it and puts it on his own head. But as the Pope returns from Paris to France, the French populace out in the countryside, whenever they see him, they are jubilant. They have demonstrations in his favor. This is evidence of a new attitude toward the papacy, which is starting to arise here in the early 1800s. It's an attitude that we refer to as Ultramontanism. Now, let's pause here in our looking at page 8 and go for a second to page 22. At the bottom of page 22, you'll find an explanation of this term, Ultramontanism. Everybody see that there? Letter F at the bottom? Ultramontanism comes from the phrase ultra montes, beyond the mountains. And the mountains being referred to are the Alps. So if you're a German, a French, a Briton, Spaniard, all of those are on the other side of the Alps. So for them, the Pope is ultramontes, beyond the Alps. So people in Europe who are pro-Pope, who want to see strong centralization of power in the papacy, become known as Ultramontanists. That's where the term comes from. Ultramontanes are supporters of the church's liberty and independence as against the state. Okay, let's go back to page 8. Yeah, let's go to page 9. Napoleon is now drunk with power. He thinks he's the most important person in the world. So he decides to annex the Papal States. The Papal States are that middle third of the Italian peninsula that had belonged to the Pope since the 700s. So he sends an army over there. They enter Rome in 1808. Napoleon declares that the Papal States are part of his empire, and Pius VII excommunicates him. At which point Napoleon says, who cares? French troops arrest Pius VII and remove him from Rome, and by stages over to France. And there he is kept imprisoned and isolated for 5 years. No news, no visitors, nothing. He has no idea what's going on. Napoleon is trying to break his will. However, Napoleon is beginning to overreach himself. He's declared war on quite a number of other countries simultaneously because they've all allied with each other against him. They see him as a great threat. There's a big battle that takes place in Leipzig, Germany. This is in the fall of 1813, and he's soundly defeated by these allied European countries. Consequently, in March 1814, the Allies enter Paris. The war is over. He's lost. He's forced to abdicate. He's no longer emperor. And he's sent in exile to an island in the Mediterranean called Elba. Well, with him out of the way, France can re-establish or reinstitute the monarchy that it had back before Napoleon and that it had back before all of that French Revolution stuff. So you get the first Bourbon restoration. I prefer Scotch, but hey. The Bourbons were the Louis, you know, Louis XIV, Louis XV, Louis XVI. Louis XVII was a child who was replaced by the French Revolution, never ruled. So the next one is Louis XVIII, and he becomes king in May 1814. Lo and behold, however, within a year, February 1815, Napoleon escapes from Elba with 600 companions. They sail over, reach the coast of France at Cannes. As he marches from Cannes on the coast up to Paris, more and more men join him. He enters Paris with 340,000 men, And Louis the 18th did exactly what you and I would do. So now we have the first empire restored. It's kind of going back and forth here. You had the monarchy, and then it got replaced by the republic with the revolution, and then Napoleon creates an empire. He gets defeated. You wind up with the monarchy again. He rises again to power, so we have the empire again. But this time it only lasts 100 days, March to June 1815, because he really bites off more than he can chew. He winds up at the Battle of Waterloo. Battle of Waterloo is June 18th, 1815. He's soundly defeated. He surrenders. He abdicates in favor of his son, who's 4 years old. He rules for 2 weeks before the British replace him. And that's it for Napoleon. He's now put on an island out in the Atlantic, where he's not likely to make it back. And he dies there. This is St. Helena, and he dies there in 1821. All right, so now the European powers have broken this massive control that France has had over European destiny for several decades. So all of these victorious powers get together in Vienna, and they hold what's called the Congress of Vienna, and they divide up Europe among themselves, these five basic powers. It's under the chairmanship of a fellow named Metternich, who's a right-winger. The Pope is still sitting in Rome. He's not invited.
Oh, I'm sorry. But the 5 years that he was in there, we didn't have a Pope? Nobody was ruling Rome?
He's still in France. Sorry. You're right. He's still in France. Yeah.
Continue that question, why he was imprisoned in France. Rome, is it controlled then by the ecumenical councils while the Pope is imprisoned? What's going on basically in Rome at the time that the Pope is not present, apart from Napoleon and France trying to control Rome at the time?
That's a good question, and I haven't read anything about that. And I wish that had occurred to me. I would have looked that up. My guess is you've got the Curia. You've still got the cardinals. And since the Pope is still the monarch of the Papal States, I assume that they would act in absentia, in his absence, rather. Yeah, takes over when the president's gone. Yeah, something like that. But I don't know. That's a good question. Okay, now we have another Bourbon restoration. Louis XVIII gets to return now that Napoleon has been exiled for the final time. He's kind of a Gallican. He likes state to control the church. He rules for 9 years. After he dies, you get Charles X, who's kind of a fanatical right-wing Catholic. At his coronation, he prostrates himself with his arms out like a priest being ordained. Well, he's so ancien regime that even the moderates in France are turned off by him. And so you have a revolution in July 1830. It's called the July Revolution, and it establishes a monarchy more to the tastes of the French. They kick him out, and they put another guy in, also related to the Bourbons. His name is Louis Philippe. And Louis Philippe is a affable sort of fellow. He's a liberal, kind of gets along with everyone, not too badly. He and his family go to mass, but the monarchy is not Catholic. There's an economic crisis, however, in 1848. And this results in another revolution, the Revolution of 1848, and Louis Philippe is forced to abdicate. So instead of that monarchy, we now have our Second Republic. The Second Republic is when the French, who are desperate for order in this economic crisis, and kind of hankering in a golden haze for the glory days of Napoleon, they decide to elect as president the nephew of Napoleon, a guy named Louis Napoleon. Most of the French Catholics want the Pope to be returned to Rome. He's still in France after all these years, obviously a new Pope, but he's still stuck in France. So a French army suppresses the Roman Republic and restores the papal monarchy. We're going to look at the Roman Republic in a second. Well, once again, the Napoleon in charge ceases to be contained and declares himself emperor. This Napoleon becomes Napoleon III because Napoleon I was the guy who got exiled to the islands, and Napoleon II was a four-year-old kid that reigned for 2 years, so here's Napoleon III declares himself emperor. He doesn't last very long. 1851 to 70. And after him, he's defeated by the Germans, basically. Franco-Prussian War. You get the Third Republic. And the Third Republic lasts from 1870 to after World War II, or beginning of World War II, when the Vichy regime takes over. Let's go to page 11. Austria-Hungary. What's going on over there? What's going on in the Holy Roman Empire in the 1800s? Well, Francis II abdicates as emperor. And consequently, in 1806, you have the abolition of the Holy Roman Empire. It ceases to exist. When did it start? It says here, First Reich, 962 to 1806. My gosh, it's been around almost 1,000 years. And here it is ended. Basically, Napoleon I forces this to happen. That's called the First Reich. The Second Reich was referred to on the preceding page. That's a unification of German states that occurs in 1871, and Hitler's the Third Reich, exactly, in the 1930s. Good. Let's go to middle of page 12. Number 4 is talking about Italy. What's going on in Italy in the 1800s? Well, Italy has a revolution. The revolutionaries are called the Carbonari, which means charcoal burners. Is that because they had campfires? I don't know. Nobody knows. They cause a revolt in Naples that gets crushed. They cause a revolt in Sardinia in 1821. The Austrians come down and save Sardinia. They have a revolt in Rome in 1831. At Gregory XVI's request, the Austrians come down and crush that. In November 1848, another revolution breaks out at Rome. So Italy is plagued with unrest and revolution throughout the first half of the 1800s. This last one, in 1848, succeeds. Pius IX flees from Rome to the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. Now here's a quote that I just dearly love. This is J toward the bottom of page 12. It was not merely accidental that just at the time when the Apostolic See lost its temporal power, it began to enjoy a plenitude of spiritual power and authority and universal esteem such as had not been evident for centuries. Isn't that interesting? Maybe the problem all along has been that the Pope was a king. Maybe if he didn't have a kingdom, one-third of Italy, to protect and try to negotiate and be on a par with all these other European powers, maybe he could have concentrated more on spiritual matters. And that, in effect, is what has happened. Because since he flees here, the papal monarchy is going to get restored by France here in the second half of the 1800s, but that's temporary. Basically, Italy is going to unite into a single country, and the Pope's temporal jurisdiction is going to become a couple of square miles that we call the Vatican. And I think that's all to the good. I think we're much better off now because of that. Okay, bottom of page 13. You've got information here that I'm hopeful you'll find interesting at home sometime. But in an hour and a half, we're not going to be able to hit everything. So let's go on to Germany. What's going on in Germany in the 1800s? Well, once again, we have one of these attempts of a European state to nationalize Catholicism, cut it off from the rest of the church and control it. Here, we're talking about Otto von Bismarck. Bismarck is the Chancellor of Germany when a bunch of these German states come together and form the German Confederation and then becomes an empire, the Second Reich, in 1871. Bismarck engages in a Kulturkampf. You remember that book by Hitler, Mein Kampf? My struggle, exactly, or my war is another translation. Here we've got a culture war. Hey, we use that phrase now, don't we? The culture wars. Basically, Bismarck and his government, which are completely Protestant, go after the Catholics in the country. Not persecuting them, but trying to control them, trying to control the top of the church. For example, here's some of the things they do. He gave legal support to the Catholics who had refused to accept papal infallibility. He fined or imprisoned any cleric who criticized the New Germany. Religious congregations are forbidden to teach. Jesuits are kicked out, some others. The state assumes control over the educational system. The state assumes control over appointment of bishops. Only Germans can hold bishoprics. Bishops have to take an oath of unconditional obedience to the government. Ecclesiastical properties are handed over to lay committees. Civil marriage is introduced. It's all the usual stuff, pretty much, that we've already seen happen in a number of places. This struggle, church and state, church and state. One might argue that that's sort of the main theme of church history. I wouldn't go that far. I think there's progress has occurred in spiritual matters. But boy, in the 1700s and 1800s, that sure does seem like the dominant theme, doesn't it? That's the main struggle. A new pope is elected. This is Leo XIII, the pope at the end of the 1800s, and he overcomes Bismarck's Kulturkampf. How does he do it? Well, for one thing, Bismarck discovers that he needs the votes of Catholic congressmen. They call them deputies. In the government of Germany. So he softens, and he's willing to negotiate. In 1878, Leo XIII begins to correspond affably with the German governor. They sort of become friends. Same year, Bismarck opens negotiations with a nuncio, a representative of the Pope. From 1880 on, the German government moderates its anti-Catholic legislation. Germany and the Holy See reestablished diplomatic relations. The Pope is asked by Bismarck to mediate between a couple of European governments having a problem, so that by 1887 Leo can announce that the Kulturkampf is over. The only heresy in the 1800s is rationalism. Hey, we already did that, so we don't need to look at it. The main thing concerning religious orders in the 18th century is the resuscitation of the Jesuits in 1824. We don't need to look at that. Let's move on to theology. What's happening theologically in the 1800s? Well, one thing is Romanticism. Romanticism is a reaction against rationalism. Rationalists said reason alone is the guide to life. And the Romanticists basically said, oh, hey, there's a lot more to life than just thinking about it. Let's enjoy our emotions. Let's smell the flowers. So there's this new emphasis on emotions. Liberal Catholicism, bottom of page 15, is a movement by theologians to work out an arrangement between the church and the newly arisen republics and democracies. They're trying to figure out how can we switch from the system that we've had for 1700 years, which is monarchs and the church, to this new system, which is going to be democracies and the church. I mean, it's a fairly new problem, and it takes several centuries to work out. Really, it gets worked out at Vatican II, I would argue, but that's next week. Stay tuned. Liberal Catholicism. There's three fellows in France who head up this attempt to make the church acknowledge the good things in democracy and cease its alliance with rather repressive authoritarian states. These three men are named Hugues Félicité Robert de Lamennais, Jean-Baptiste Henri Dominique Lacordaire, and Charles Farrell Brunet, Comte de Montalembert. Suffice it to say, these three fellows start up a newspaper called L'Avenir, which means future, the future. And in it, they argue for an alliance between the church and democratic freedom to replace the alliance between throne and altar. They support freedom of conscience. They support separation of state. They support democratic republicanism and national self-determination. They support social and economic reform. Well, obviously, they get attacked because a lot of the clergy, and in fact, probably the majority of the Catholics in France, are still under the thousand and more year old assumption that you can't have an altar without a throne. You can't have the church survive unless it's supported by the state. So the three friends, one is a priest, one's a Dominican, and one is a layman. The three friends decide to go to Rome. They write up a document expressing their beliefs. They feel confident that the Pope will support them. So they take this document to Rome. They present it to the Pope. The Pope says, thanks, I'll look at this later. And very shortly thereafter, the Pope comes out with an encyclical which completely contradicts them. This is the encyclical, two-thirds of the way down, page 16. August 1832, Gregory XVI's encyclical Mirari Vos. It doesn't mention Lamennais, it doesn't mention L'Avenir, but it's obviously aimed at them. It disapproves the separation of church and state. It says freedom of the press is abominable. It condemns universal liberty of conscience as sheer madness. The three friends immediately submit, but one of them probably does so with reservations because shortly thereafter he leaves the church. This is Lamennais, who's really kind of the ringleader of the three. And he goes off the deep end. He starts saying things like, bottom of page 16, he denounces the conspiracy of kings and priests against the people. He says, Christ condemns the Pope and hierarchy because power is the child of hell and priests are only lackeys of kings. While the other two friends desert him and say, wait a minute, whoa, we don't agree. 17, top of 17. He denies original sin. He denies the divinity of Christ. He denies eternal punishment. He denies the existence of the supernatural. So he's completely lost. The other two, however, remain fervent, loyal Catholics and continue to try and promote some kind of a reconciliation between democracy and the church. And they sort of lay the foundation, the framework for what ultimately gets said at Vatican II. If you want details on them, that's first two-thirds of page 17. In the meantime, the Pope Pius IX, publishes an encyclical that kind of reinforces what had just been said in Mirari Vos, that earlier one. And along with it, there's kind of an appendix called the Syllabus of Errors. Now, this Syllabus of Errors has 80 quotations from Pius IX over the preceding 12 or 15 years. And these quotations are taken out of their original context and just listed. That's the Syllabus of Errors. It came out in 1864. So here are some of the things that the Syllabus of Error considers to be errors. Man is free to profess the religion he believed to be true, guided by reason. That's not true, according to this document. Those outside the true church can hope for eternal salvation. Not true, according to this document. It's possible to achieve salvation in the practice of any religion. Not true, says the Syllabus of Errors. True, says Vatican II. The church cannot use force or temporal power. The church should separate from the state. These are all things that are called errors. The Catholic religion should not be the exclusive religion of the state. And here's the real zinger at the bottom of page 17, error number 80. The Roman, and this is an exact quote, the Roman pontiff can and ought to reconcile and harmonize himself with progress, with liberalism, and with modern civilization. That's an error. What it's saying is the Pope shouldn't reconcile with progress and modern civilization. Well, top of page 18, the average Catholic was shocked to hear the Pope condemning progress and modern civilization. It's like he's against gaslighting in the streets or something. The various technological innovations that are making life better. In fact, however, if some of these statements are put back into the original documents that they were cut from and listed by themselves, it turns out that they're not nearly as horrific as they sound. This last one, for example, I'm at letter B, a third of the way down page 18. The apparent condemnation of progress and liberalism was taken from a document denouncing the extension of secular laws in Piedmont to territories recently occupied by the growing Kingdom of Italy. Unfortunately, however, not all Catholics were Italians, and they failed to see the, quote, errors in terms of the dissolution of monasteries or the imposition of secular education. What the Pope had actually said in the original document was, by civilization, I mean a system invented to overthrow the church. So when he says, it's not true that I, as Pope, have to reconcile with modern civilization, what he's saying is, I, as Pope, don't have to reconcile with a system that's going to overthrow the church. But if you just look at the excerpt that was added to the syllabus, it doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds like he's against modern civilization. So this document was very problematical. It wasn't infallible. But even aside from that, it's not nearly as horrific as it appears out of context. What's going on in America in the 1800s? Here, of course, we're doing history of the Catholic Church, so we're only going to talk about what's going on with Catholicism. Well, toward the end of the century, there arises a movement of liberal Catholicism. Liberal Catholicism means trying to reconcile the church and democracy. And this movement is referred to as Americanism. Americanism, bottom of page 18, advocated adapting Catholicism to American society. It promotes separation of church and state, recognition of the English common law, democratic procedures, like presumed innocent until proven guilty, reform of ecclesiastical administration. Suffice it to say, the bishops were divided. Some of the bishops, John Ireland of St. Paul, Minnesota, Cardinal Gibbon Baltimore, John O'Connell, etc., Richmond, Some of them are very pro, quote, Americanism. Other bishops, however, are still in that ancien regime type mode of thinking of the past, and they oppose this. You got lots of details here on page 19 about it, but let's go to the bottom of page 19 where you have Leo XIII putting out an encyclical, apparently on Americanism. It's called Testem Benevolente. It showed up in 1899, and it said, the notion of adapting the doctrines, though not the practices of the church, to modern society is condemned. Well, the conservatives among the bishops of America say thank you, and the liberals say, we accept that, but hey, we never said that anyway. We never argued that doctrine ought to be changed, just practices. Liberal Catholicism, which is the attempt to reconcile the church with democracy, is one of the two great theological movements, one of the three great theological movements in the 1800s. A second great theological movement is called social Catholicism. There's liberal Catholicism, that's reconciling the church and democracy, and there's social Catholicism, that's reconciling the church and workers, the condition of workers in an industrial revolution period. And so here's where you get things like Catholic Action. Catholic Action is mentioned a fourth of the way down on page 20 at number 3. The central office of Catholic Action is established. Catholic Action was the name of many groups of lay Catholics who were attempting to encourage a Catholic influence on society. Bottom of page 20, a bishop in Germany is very involved in workers' rights. His name was Ketteler, Bishop of Mainz. Ketteler supported demands for higher wages and trade unions. He advocated legislation to improve the working conditions of men, and he advocated legislation to control the work of women and children. So this is what we mean by social Catholicism. It eventually is going to become what nowadays we refer to as social justice. So it succeeds eventually, just as liberal Catholicism succeeds eventually. Leo XIII puts out an encyclical on social Catholicism. This is in top of page 22. In 1891, and it's called Rerum Novarum. He condemns individualistic liberalism, which says the state and not the family is the ultimate unit of society. He condemns unrestricted capitalism, and he says the government ought to intervene to safeguard the spiritual and material interests of workers. Workers should be paid a family living wage. Workers have the right to form trade unions. But it also condemns revolutionary socialism, which would say that private property is not a right. The state owns everything. So Leo XIII is coming out with a kind of a balanced statement and condemning both extremes. It's the foundation document for the church's social justice teachings. Neo-scholasticism is a push for the teaching of Aquinas, who was the chief of the scholastic theologians in the Middle Ages. Leo XIII in 1879 put out an encyclical called Aeterni Patris, which says that all seminaries should form clerics according to the teachings of Thomas Aquinas. That's a movement in theology. I would say the third great movement in theology in the 1800s is this ultramontanism that we referred to briefly before. Ultramontanism promotes centralization of power in the church. And this is promoted especially because all the individual countries are trying to decentralize it. Each country is trying to carve out its own portion of the Catholic Church. So this push to increase the central power of the Pope is necessary, to my eyes, looking backward. How does this go about happening? Well, 1854, what does the Pope do? He declares the Immaculate Conception to be doctrine, dogma. And he does it without an ecumenical council. He stands forth by himself and says, this is Catholic dogma, all Catholics must believe this. This was a obvious way to say, conciliarism is wrong, I don't need an ecumenical council, I myself have infallibility as a pope. That's 1854. 1870, the Pope calls together all the bishops in the world for an ecumenical council. This is Vatican I. And they say two things. One thing they say is the Pope has ultimate jurisdiction over all Catholics. This had been believed before, but not affirmed doctrinally like that. Secondly, the Pope has infallibility. Now, they were planning to discuss about 50 other items on the agenda, but the Franco-Prussian War breaks out, and they have to suspend their discussions. They were going to talk about the nature of the church and the relation between popes and bishops. All of that sort of gets here, and it winds up discussed at Vatican II, as we'll see next time. Page 24, a final quotation. Letter C. Vatican I eliminated the remnants of the conciliar movement. Can you see that? You see why that happened? Yes, good. It crushed ecclesiastical nationalism. So all of those efforts, Gallicanism, Richerism, Josephinism, what are the others? Febronianism, etc. Those are dead now because of what Vatican II has done. Vatican I, thank you. I never was good at math. But, on the other hand, the Church appeared to be committed to the obscurantist policies of Pius IX. Like the syllabus of errors. He had shown little understanding of political realities, social and economic trends, and the intellectual developments of the age. So, ultramontanism has triumphed. Social Catholicism is on a solid footing, but liberal Catholicism is tabled. And that's going to be the problem for the next century. All right. Thank you very much.